Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Detraction Pieces Podcast, episode 243. And it's been a long-awaited one. This week I'm joined by Mr. Boots Riley. I know a lot of you have been awaiting this. Very excited about... Sorry to bother you getting a release over here. If you follow me on Twitter in particular, me and Boots have been talking, going back and forth when they didn't have distribution about, you know, trying to get distribution in the UK, because it's been kind of the unexpected hit of the year in America. And initially, because it's kind of an indie, initially he was told that there wasn't a market for essentially black cinema in the UK, and that couldn't be more ridiculous, particularly when this film is... It's black cinema, sure, but it's also a million other things. It's one of the most bonkers films I've ever seen, but I absolutely adored it. I'm pretty sure it's going to be in my end of the year films list. As some of you know, I do that on social media and on the podcast. So I'll be recording a podcast to go out early January this time. I'm getting as many films in as I can. I'm going to keep this intro relatively short. And I'm going to do a longer outro because I'm just playing about with stuff like that, because I keep having a lot I want to chat to you about and talk to you about. But I'm aware that some of you are here specifically for Boots and the conversation. So I'll mention briefly that you can support the podcast at patreon.com/scroobiouspip or at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, which is where I've got a load of merch. Me and Boots talk about our music careers and the crossovers and stuff like that. So if you head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, you can see there's tons of merch there and all sorts of other stuff. And actually, he speaks of seeing me do spoken word in London years ago. And my Edinburgh Fringe show is a spoken word show, which is available on DVD and digital download in the web store. So yeah, check all that out. There's no real spoilers in this. We talk a lot about, you know, we kind of avoid spoilers. You might benefit from seeing the film first, but you'll benefit from seeing the film in general before or after. So sorry to bother you, is out on Friday, December 7th. So I couldn't recommend it more. And it's important to go and support and see in the cinema. Number one, it's important to see in the cinema because the world in it is so bonkers, as I've said, that if you watch it at home, you're not going to be able to immerse in it in the way that it's genuinely an experience and a joy to immerse in this crazy thing on the big screen, in the dark, with a good sound system and all this kind of thing. So yeah, I recommend going and seeing it in the cinema. And important to support and to prove that Britain, Brexit Britain, all the same, there's still a huge market for what may be deemed black cinema, but... is a million other things as well. So let's get into this. This is episode 200. Oh, and also, obviously, another reason of people have been waiting for this is because on the Spike Lee episode, which is one of the episodes of the year, I brought up Boots' issues with Black Klansman, and Spike elected not to comment. So I obviously had to then bring that up with Boots, which is only fair. So I'll be back at the end. If you enjoy this one, go and have a listen to the Spike Lee one. Other ones you might enjoy, Jean Grey, Sage Francis and B. Dolan early in the year. I know they're pals with Boots. Killer Mike previously, great episode with some similar outlooks on activism in and out of music. Saul Williams, Akala, tons of really good people. Check them out. Also, I mean, obviously, earlier in the year, I had Patrice Cluze, who was the starter of Black Lives Matter. So we discuss a lot of activism stuff here, so it might be relevant. But anyway, I said I'm going to keep this brief. This is still reasonably brief. How long are we on? It's like 5 minutes, if that, so chill. Although you will have also had adverts, so it's probably about an hour. This is episode 243 of the Detraction Pieces Podcast with Boots Riley. I'll see you again at the end. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro. just chat and catch up as we go. I've stopped making a music for a bit. It's a weird one. I stopped for a year to try this acting lark out, and then it went better than I could have expected. And kind of 3-4 years on, I'm doing stuff with the BBC and with FX in America and stuff like that. And I'm kind of like, well, I might get back to the music at some point, but the film stuff is what's exciting me the most. Yeah. And writing scripts as well, I'm working on all that kind of thing. That's where my drive is right now. So it's an interesting one. But I should introduce, I'm joined today by Boots O'Reilly. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I actually saw you one time here. I was in London. I don't remember when it was, but I had just heard your thing like on the plane or something like that.
Amazing.
And then I came to some sort of a poetry thing.
Oh, that's awesome. Like that. I love that. I saw you up a mountain in Japan once.
Oh,
I was doing Fuji Rocks in 2008. I saw you with Galactica.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, that was my first. I'd heard your name around. That was my first exposure. And then I've caught the coupe.
Cool.
Around the way as well. So it's kind of, it's been exciting watching this journey. And I mean, before we get into everything, it's exciting that you're here because it's not been an easy path, right? Like you and I had been talking in DMs about the kind of the struggle that you were getting at. You've made this film. It's been a blow away underdog success in America. And then you were kind of struggling to get it released in the UK. You were being told that there wasn't a market for black cinema and stuff like that.
Yeah, this was what at first the folks at Annapurna who were trying to sell it to other markets were being told.
Yeah.
So luckily we got some great distributors now, Universal.
Yeah.
They're
It'd be better, right? And premiering at the London Film Festival.
Yeah.
It's dope.
Yeah, this is, it feels like a important. I'm a filmmaker.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It's exciting to see. And we'll get into, obviously, we're here to talk mainly about, sorry to bother you, genuinely, it's the first film I've ever gone into and made pages and pages of notes. I brought my notebook along because I was like, I need to prove this, that I was literally just scribbling away and trying to get the balance of just sit back and enjoy it or try and take in all that's happening because it's a dense film layers-wise. But before we get into all that, let's kind of talk about the music or more when you were growing up. Was it always about film and music, or was music the thing that took you?
When I was when I was a kid, it was just all about TV.
That's
all it was. It's TV. I don't even think we got to go to movies that much. I remember like the big movies. I mean, I saw movies once they were on TV.
Of course.
And then it was about, you know, around the age of 12, just wanting to be Prince.
Yeah. It's a solid goal, man. It's a solid goal.
Yeah, I wanted to be Prince. And although I was taking guitar, piano, and trumpet, I did not want to practice as much as it would take to become Prince, but I just wanted to be that. And then I got into organizing at about the age of 14.
And where was this? Because you were born in Chicago, right? But grew up in Detroit and a few different places.
Was in Oakland by the time I was six.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah.
So, this was in Oakland. And I was 14 years old, and a youth organizer showed up at my house with a van full of 14-year-old girls saying, "You want to go to the beach?" And I was like, "Yeah." And they were like, "But first, we got to go to the Watsonville cannery workers strike and support that." And I was like, I just heard girls and beach and got into the van.
It's a good sale.
You know, and that was it. And by the time I was 15, I had joined a radical organization called the Progressive Labor Party. Yeah, and so I was also doing plays at the same time. My grandmother ran the Oakland Ensemble Theater.
Right.
And so I was around that, but I also did plays in school, and part of the organizing I ended up really kind of cutting my teeth on was helping out farm workers in the Central California Valley. And there was a tradition that had been there from Teatro Campesino of people who used plays to in theater to put across ideas. So
yeah,
I had that going, and Spike Lee came along, and I was like, okay, I don't have to just do plays for 40 people at a time. Maybe I could do movies. So then I was doing music and organizing and theater, and then went to film school at San Francisco State. But there they focused mainly on experimental and documentary. And this is the 89, early 90s. And there's no YouTube, no Netflix. So where are you going to play a documentary? You know, who's going to watch experimental film outside of a museum?
Netflix have legit changed the game on documentaries. Yeah. Documentaries were something that a very select few people watch.
Now just average everyday people. Yeah. Average everyday people would be like, I only watch documentaries.
Yeah.
And some of that is, in a weird way, due to like reality shows. Like reality shows have sold a certain kind of format, so people are like, oh, I want a documentary.
Yeah.
But we were in Oakland at a time when every record label had to have a group from Oakland.
Yeah.
And so we got a record deal and I quit film school.
It's a fascinating one. I was discussing this with Doc Brown, who in fact is interviewing you tonight at the BFI, as we record this at the BFI. And when I was discussing with him, because he's another one like you who was doing film and TV, or was doing comedy, or originally was doing some acting stuff, and then he blew up doing music, and then went into comedy, and then he's gone from comedy into acting. And we were discussing how it's all about at what point people got on the train. Because again, you will have had a lot of people who were saying, oh, how is it going from music into filmmaking, into this kind of thing? It's like, well, no, that's what you were always doing. It's just you happened to first find me as a musician. This is all stuff that I've... And again, it's similar with me. I was making just little indie films with my mates long before I started doing music. It just happens that this is the point that a lot of people found me.
And so for me, it's like a lot of the same creative processes anyway. It's like putting together ideas. Actually, writing screenplays is a lot easier for me than writing lyrics, because a lot of times I might have a scene or a situation in my head that I'm trying to figure out the poetry of, or, you know, like translate into some, like, what's the essence of this and what is that? And like getting like a line from that. And for writing a screenplay, I'm like taking away like this whole big filtering thing.
Yeah.
That I'm
doing, yeah. Yeah.
And kind of just putting the scene there.
Yeah. Yeah. Just painting it out as it is rather than through different filters. Yeah,
And there's filters, obviously, because it's never as it is.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
It's having some fun with it. So how was it to suddenly be signed and suddenly be touring about? It's great that the activism never went away there. You know, if it was a time when people wanted bands from Oakland, then you were kind of there to go, all right, well, let's put some politics into this. Let's bring some activism into this.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the drive of everything I was doing by that time anyway. So, like, I don't think I would have been an artist.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think I would have had, you know, the drive.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for the fact that I had an ideal worldview that I wanted to communicate.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that was my whole reason for doing it.
Yeah. So how natural has it been, or what kind of spurred you to go, it's time for me to make a film now, to pause the music or whatever and go in this direction?
It's interesting. So I have had this other band with Tom Morello.
Yeah.
Called Street Sweeper Social Club.
Yeah, yeah.
And me and Tom have been good friends since like 2003. And
he's amazing. Again, people who only know him from Rage need to know about the Street Sweeper, him touring with Springsteen, who in my mind is up there with Prince.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that guy from the heavy metal band, again, like Rage are one of my favorite bands ever, but that guy from the metal band is now in the E Street band, essentially.
Yeah,
yeah. It's madness.
And he's got the Night Watchman.
The Night Watchman stuff.
Yeah, and yeah, no. But for all the talking about people working together and being cooperative that both me and Tom do, I think it's really hard for people to like collaborate and work together. Like this, we had it kind of set up where he did the music,
yeah,
and I did the lyrics. And for me, coming from a situation with the coup where it's like all my vision.
Yeah.
You know, that it ended up kind of being a frustrating situation because, you know, and also with that, like, Rage made so many classic songs that you hear those riffs coming out of Tom and you're like waiting for Zach to come on.
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah, of course. That's a tough one, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the thing is, I came out of that situation like feeling like, okay, I need to make something that's just out of my brain, that's all the way, like, you know, because it's just me and the laptop, you know, or me and the pad of paper where I'm writing ideas down. So that came from there. But the whole time I'd been wanting to make movies and things like that. And probably the oldest idea in that movie is there's an argument between Cassius and Sal, his best friend. And that happens in front of people who haven't seen it won't know, but it happens in front of the telemarketing place, and it's
like a polite off.
It's
a compliment off almost. But there's an aggression in it, but
yeah, so that was something that happened to my little brother years and years before, and I was like, I'm gonna put that in a movie one day. The thing is, I'd been wanting to make films. With all our videos, I was always either I was a big part of it, or sometimes co-directing or whatever, but I would be, you know, writing the treatment, doing storyboards, and camping out in the editing room. So kind of what I do as a producer is very similar, which is basically working with people who are masters of their craft and getting them to follow my vision.
Yeah.
You know, that's in music. And getting them to buy into it, not just, you know, because it's the job, but understanding how each of them work and what I need from them, and getting them hyped on what they can bring, and then also understanding that the guitar player wants to do a guitar solo, not because it's necessarily going to make the song better, but because he's a guitarist.
Yeah.
And so knowing that all of that just kind of lent itself to creating a film.
And that's it. It's that, I think, one of the great keys of great producers is the ability to play the band as such. I was talking to Liam Howlett the other day about this, of The Prodigy, and he was saying it took them years to get their live thing right, because he realised that he had to not just let the drummer be the drummer. He had to figure out where the drummer fits in their live show, and it was simple things like he stripped out all the bass from the drums, because the bass had to come from Liam, from drum machines, from production, for it to work. Yeah. And finding that, and the same with the guitarist, exactly as you were saying, rather than going, well, do your thing, because a guitarist wants to be a guitarist, but in this thing, he's an instrument. He's playing an instrument, but he's also an instrument. So it's finding the people who can control that and do it in a fair way, in a credible way, in not a kind of manipulative way, but in going, look, I know here's what you want to do, but just trust me. Better if we go this way. It's going to have more impact.
People always say, what do you play? And I'll be like, I play musicians.
Yeah.
And you know, it can be taken wrong. It's not like Ike Turner, but... It's just, you know, you understand how those things work. And so, yeah, all of that lent itself into directing.
Yeah. So one of the things that kept getting me excited as I was watching the film was... the context of it was the fact that this is a debut, and it was blowing my mind how you get to make this film as a debut, because this film takes risks. This film is out there. It's crazy. It's making some amazing points. It's got so many layers, but it feels like a film that's your second or third. You kind of, you've got in the door and now you're being allowed to flex your artistic muscle.
Yeah.
How did you come about having this as your first film, having that freedom, I guess?
Yeah, I think the difference is some people may just want to be a filmmaker. And so, I'm more likely to be able to make a film if I don't do these things, or if I do these things.
Yeah.
But I didn't just want to be a filmmaker. I wanted to make this film.
Yeah.
And so that, all those risks, those things that are risky are part of what it attracts me to it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no version of me being like, oh, I'm a filmmaker, I just made heist film number 3, you know, the one that has Marky Mark, and but where he gets killed at the end or something. Yeah, you know,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it definitely is like I want, you know, I have the reason that I'm doing a thing is because of the art itself.
Yeah.
So I think that's just really a part of it. And part of what helped me sell it to people that were financing it without it being like scaled down in different ways is that it was so much not something else.
Yeah.
That nobody really could speak with authority about how to make it more this thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, I love that.
Yeah.
That's a clever point because it's not saying that, oh, this is the new this or this is the new that. It's going, this is its own thing. It's its own creature. So what were the cinematic and kind of filmic influences on this one?
Yeah, a lot. So one thing I did learn from music, you know, I went early on when I started doing stuff, I had a lot of influences in music and I would shave a lot of them off because I'd say, okay, this is what hip hop is. This is what it's supposed to be. This is what people want out of it when you say you're delivering them this thing. But as I went on, I realized the main thing that I needed to give people was passion. So I started allowing myself to have all these influences in there. And I combined that, this is all leading up to the answer to that. I combined that story with, also when I first started off, I really wanted to sound like Ice Cube.
Yeah.
I really needed desperately to sound like Ice Cube.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was not able to.
Aim for the top, right?
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I would get mad at other artists who were able to sound like Ice Cube. Like, oh, fuck. Oh, wow. They're obviously going to be around forever because they could sound just like Ice Cube.
Yeah.
And what I wasn't aware of is that I had all of these things influencing everything from my tone to the things I wanted to talk about to all, and they were all like kind of combining to make this thing that, because it was different at first, I'd be like, oh, who's gonna like that,
you know?
But all of those influences did that. So I've learned that I can wear my influences on my sleeve, but the best thing is for me to have a lot of sleeves, a lot of influences, and it creates something new. So, I mean, there's this movie called Black Cat, White Cat by Amir Kusturica.
Right.
And another one he made called Underground that kind of has the chaos and the energy that I really wanted to have in this film. There's a movie called Mishima by Paul Schrader.
Right.
Who, a matter of fact, I stole one scene from there. You know, and people say to say paid homage to, but I stole it. And
damn right.
It's not a scene, but it's and some of it is in the trailer where he's just becoming obsessed by the golden elevator.
Yeah.
And some of the crowd scenes in like Michael Cimino films like Deer Hunter and Heaven's Gate, the way that he and Milos Forman too, like Fireman's Ball and Loves of a Blonde, the way that they work with crowds to develop scale and things that you can't do it's hard to do for independent films to have that scale, because once you talk to an extra, then they're not an extra if you're the director. But doing it in Oakland, you know, the loophole is like if they're friends and family, obviously, they can't stop you from talking to them. So I know so many people in Oakland that the crowd is all, you know, like people I know. So we were able to get some of that. So, but, you know, I'm interested in how they make these things seem real and feel real.
Yeah.
So those things. And we tried to go for some of the, like, in some of the wide shots, some of the feel of, like, Sergei Parajanov, Color of Pomegranates, things like that, where they're are these wide shots that have all these details in the composition, but there definitely is some contrast between one of the smaller things that makes it a little bit more simple. It's hard to describe. Then there's some other ones that are more well-known, like Kubrick is definitely a big influence. And sort of the weightiness of those things, like this is a film, this is an important film, you know, and feeling like every aspect of it is important. This is not just a shot where somebody gets from this room to that room.
Yeah.
This is, you know, this has importance. And what am I saying with this? And how am I, you know, what visually, where, what am I doing? So all of those details are things that got me excited.
Completely. And both of those references there, I think, are absolutely key in that there's so much packed into this, but at no point does any of it overpower the story and the point of that scene. There's clearly so much imagery and reference in the backgrounds. As you said, there can be tons going on, but you're still making sure the focus is mm-hmm. on the important points. So if you want to go back and watch and yeah. pick apart all these little things, yeah. then you can. But it's not a film that's going, oh, look at how clever we are. Yeah. Look at how much I've packed in here. It's yeah. it's packing it all in for yourself as an artist, but not letting that detract from the viewing experience.
Yeah.
So yeah. so what kind of director have you found yourself to be? There's, again, it kind of struck me as, because of the amount of layers, the script will have been incredibly important. There's a theme going throughout the film of STTS, stick mm-hmm. to the script. Are you a stick to the script kind of director, or are you because again, you've cast mm-hmm. we'll get onto the cast, but you've cast amazing people who yeah. you can therefore put a lot of trust in mm-hmm. to, you know, to do their thing.
And well, so there definitely were times when, you know, a scene is being performed and I'll be like, wait a minute, that sounds stupid. Whoever wrote that, which is me, you know, it's a bad writer. So I, you know, you come to certain realizations and you're playing with it. And, you know, that's the other thing from music. You have this vision, but then you have to have your ego attached to the final thing as opposed to
yeah.
to all these steps. So, yeah, there was, you know, improvisation on all of our parts. Like, you know, what am I going to hire a cinematographer for if they're only going to shoot exactly what I thought in the first place?
100%.
So I have the idea, but then they're like, no, check this out. And sometimes I think they're wrong. A lot of times they're right.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's what that collaboration is for. You know, and all the time we're trying to figure out how to crank it up. You know, like, what's the emotional essence of this? Okay, where, how can I take this another level? And so some of that happened before pre-production or during pre-production, but some of that happened like right then and there. Like the scene, there's some flip papers flying behind him, and
yeah.
he looks over to his right and says, you're really gonna stuff, and he's in the office, but he looks over to his right and says, you're really gonna stuff all those French fries in your mouth. And we go to the other scene, and we look over, and we're in another place, and it just kind of leads into that. But that was just figuring it out right then. I mean, I didn't know if it was going to work.
I love that, because that was a scene that jumped out and feels like that's such a stylistic choice that's yeah. been set out before you've started everything. So that's beautiful yeah. to hear that those stylistic choices can continue to be yeah. made if you're collaborating with the right people.
And especially, like, we were doing this at such a low budget that locations were falling through, this and that, and we had to, like, pick things like the power calling suite. Like, we had this other one that still, this other location that still makes me mad that we don't have it. And we didn't get it because WeWork bought it, even though they weren't going to move in for another year. It was going to be empty. They heard that we were going to be shooting, and they did not want us there. I don't know if you have WeWork out here, but
no,
fuck them.
Yeah.
And
no,
they're kind of, like, worry-free. But,
right, yeah. I was going to say, it sounded like something anyway, from the film there.
So we're, you know, like, okay, fuck, we got to, on our 5 hours off, go look at these other possible locations. And, you know, okay, this place has these reflections right here. That's amazing. And it has those lights. So we're going to build everything off of this. And that's like a improvisation right there, because we had a whole different look for the power calling yeah. suite, and we based everything off of the hallway that you see in the trailer with Omari Hardwick, and there's these lights that are going behind him, and that's why we picked yeah. that. You know, so there's all of this stuff going, and a lot of that ability, and at the same time as having reverence for the plan and irreverence for the plan, is, you know, all part of it. And again, yes, having amazing actors who, one, will roll with the punches and stay in the moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, come up like Lakeith is somebody who his whole thing, you know, and I got scared at first, you know, like I was trying to extra plan for everything. And a couple months before, I was like, so when are you going to get off book? When are you going to remember your lines?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, I tried not to do that till a couple days before. And I'm like, oh, shit. Because I'm trying to, like, I'm nervous. I'm like, I'm trying to have everything figured out beforehand.
Yeah.
And at first I didn't understand it. But then I really got it because he's, you know, it's not that he's not preparing.
Yeah.
Because he's remembering all these parts, but he's in the moment. And when his delivery, part of it is trying to figure out what the next thing he's supposed to say is.
Yeah.
Which is what we're doing in life.
Completely.
Right?
Completely. It's weird. It surprises people all the time that with these podcasts, if I can, I'll try to only prepare the night before or the morning of. And that's not a laziness or a last... a minute thing. I'll have a few days spare, but I'll hold off because I want exactly that. I want to have that freshness of thought and that freshness of reaction in there.
But yeah, so yeah, we did storyboards, we did all this kind of stuff. And the good thing about it is knowing you got it just in case, you know, and we had shot lists that we did during pre-production, all this sort of stuff. But being able to be like, okay, we know we need this, but being able to go within. For instance, I had this whole choreography that happens between Armie Hammer and Lakeith. Armie is Steve Lifton, Lakeith is Cassius, that had to do with them getting up. There were all these things that happened that I had done at the Sundance Lab. So part of this was part of my process. I can't leave out is the Sundance Labs. I did the writer's lab and did the director's lab. And
right.
In the director's lab, you get to like, you're doing it with other people, but you get to like shoot five scenes.
Oh, wow.
And kind of figure stuff out. And had I not done that, the pacing and the acting would have been, it helped me figure out how to talk to actors about certain things.
That's amazing.
All the, so, but I had this choreography worked out. You know, and Armie said at one point, well, Steve Lift wouldn't get up. You know, it just doesn't make sense. And I was like, shit, you're right. You know, and so kind of rethought the whole thing.
I love that.
Based on that.
Again, it's having the faith in knowing that the actor now knows that character possibly better than you do. Because you've had to know every character. They've just had to get to know that one character. Yeah. And that's a beautiful thing, to find those collaborators who you can do that with, right?
And then the question becomes, is the choreography more important than... there's certain places where you back into this thing because there's this other thing you're trying to get to. And then there's other times where you like, no, I need the actor to be all the way in it.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. And I need to base everything off of that.
Yeah. So how's the casting go on a project like this? Because people like Lakeith has just been mind-blowing in Atlanta and in Get Out and things like that. And Tessa Thompson, it's endless. Creed, A Ragnarok, Westworld, Annihilation, all these things. Mm-hmm. But then also people like Terry Crews. And, I mean, I always want to refer to him as James St. Patrick because I'm a Power fan. But Omar Hardwick, mm-hmm. And just all these different people. How was it getting that cast together, and how exciting was it as it started to come together? Because as soon as I saw the trailer, I was like, oh shit, he's in it. Oh, she's in it. Oh, he's in it. Like, it's more and more. You're like, oh wow, this is
a hell of a cast. It was like the team building montage on a heist movie.
Yeah.
But without that part, that lag part afterward where you know you can go to the bathroom. Definitely. I think... you know, once by the time I hired Lakeith, because I had gone through Sundance, the script was becoming known. Like, agents knew about it. And, you know, they didn't necessarily think it would be anything, but they knew about it. And certain actors knew about it. And I think the question was, there was still a question of what is it? What's the tone going to be? How is he going to pull this off? And I think once I hired Lakeith, he hadn't been in Get Out. There had only been two episodes of Atlanta out, and I hadn't even seen him yet. You know, until I saw him only because I was looking at stuff of his, and but other actors knew how great he was.
Yeah,
and there were other larger actors at the time.
Yeah,
that you know maybe an agent would normally be like, try for that person. Or an investor would say that, but hiring him sent out a flare to the other actors of what kind of movie this was going to be.
Perfect.
You know, and as a matter of fact, a year before I had written an email to Tessa Thompson that she only answered after I hired Lakeith.
Amazing.
You know, but by that time and by that time I actually was we were already in the midst of chemistry reads with other actors and for the role of Detroit, and I had some of my own favorites, and I kind of also was like, oh, you're not going to return my email for a year, like whatever. And I had also, I guess, incorrectly heard that she was offer only, like I guess she normally is offer only. And so I was like, I'm not going to, you know, that relationship is so important that I don't care how great the actor is that plays her, I need to see them together.
Yeah, completely.
And there was a good chance because of everybody's schedule, there was not going to be a way to see them together until they were there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the compromise was a three-way Skype session.
Yeah.
With Lakeith in L.A., Tessa in New York, and me in Oakland. Like I said, I had my favorite, so I was like, okay, I'll do this just to go through the motions, but there's no way I'm going to see what I need to see over Skype. But there was fire on the laptop.
Yeah.
And they weren't even in the same place. And so I, you know, I was like, okay, this is it. And
was there a balance of excitement and frustration? Because if you're there kind of going, fuck this, you know, I've got my phone. And then you're like, ah, oh, shit, they're really good. This is exciting. But also, I had my favourites. I was ready to be, I'll do this. Yeah. I'll do service to this. And then you're like, oh, shit, this is the film, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely. you have to be okay with being wrong.
Yeah.
And that same, you know, music producer thing, you also know if the bass player comes with a better bass line, you could be like, oh, shit, oh. Now you're going to get writer's credit. You could be like, no, fuck that. We're staying on our same thing. Mm-hmm. Or you could be like, we're making the best song possible. Yes, 100%. Let's use that bass line.
Absolutely, you know? Key. So, I mean, you spoke about the tone. And one of the key things, I think, to the tone was the wardrobe. I mean, there was... It's such a striking look. The bloody bandage looked amazing and became a little icon on Twitter with the hashtag as the film came out. But everything from Detroit's earrings to her wearing a jacket that I've seen you wear live at gigs, and you know, Omari had very familiar facial hair. How much of all that was kind of key to it? Was making everyone look kind of
striking? Me, like every single detail is important. So, one, we had this idea. I had this idea that of that I call beautiful clutter that really went from everything from the way the story is set up to the production design to the costume design and on is that and to the editing, which is that a lot of times there's this idea, especially in black aesthetics that I've been involved in, you know, since I've been an adult, which is kind of this upwardly mobile sort of thing of things being smooth and clean. And, you know, interestingly enough, like doing music coming out of Oakland. Oakland is a small place. You know, it's like 400,000 people. And once you are there, that you become your representative of Oakland. And to the point that people will actually come to you and tell you what songs you should be doing to represent Oakland better. This is the kind of music you should be making. This is what it should sound like. That's like, what are you, that last song you put out? No, you need to make some clean stuff. So this idea of things being clean is something versus sloppy or messy or something like that. George Clinton talks about it at the beginning of Mommy, What's a Funkadelic, about him, you know, slicking back his hair and going away from that hard blues sound, which they call funk, and going away because it was messy and dirty. That was something, and then they had to go back to it to make Funkadelic.
Yeah.
And so I wanted, you know, this, I wanted something that felt like a collage, like, you know, and in you know, aesthetically and had that messiness and jagged edge to it. And with the clothing, we made everything mean something.
Yeah.
And we had amazing costume designer, Deirdre Govan, amazing production designer, Jason Kisvarde. Yeah, where everything was about something. And it was like a constant, like, going back and forth. Like, so, for instance, with Mr., which is just Mr., with yeah, Omari's yeah. character, which is Mr. in seven underscores. At first, in the script, he's called Fancy Suit Guy. But then I realized that it's hard to get across the fact that something's fancy, like, like that something's an expensive suit or a fancy suit on screen. Like, it's hard to see that. Because also, we see everything. It's kind of like CGI. You can have a building get up and take a shit, and it wouldn't matter because we've seen it. We're watching a film, you know. Yeah. So how do we take that and just not have them be? So we decided to do that with different colors and patterns and things like that. And I found an eye patch. And then that, like, let a storm loose, because then I found the eye patch. Then Deirdre wanted to do the bowler hat.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay. And, you know, I had to think about all these things. Are we going too far? Then Omari was like, man, I want to do the sideburns and all that kind of stuff. And so all of this stuff is being talked about. Tessa was also very involved in, like, we figured out her hair beforehand, but that was, like, very much like a collaboration. Like, how do we figure that out? And then her also figuring stuff out with Deirdre. Yeah. So, like, it's all, like, everybody working together and having fun and being part of all of this stuff, which is a big part of why, you know, all through the campaign in the U.S., the cast has been, like, really out there because, like, we created this.
Yeah, together. They've all been involved. Well, we've not really got time to go into it as we're wrapping things up, but I do need to kind of mention at the end, because it was in this very room that I got my first ever no comment in an interview, and I mentioned it to you, but it's because I had Spike Lee on, and I wanted to discuss what you had put forward in opposition to Black Klansman, and I felt it got ripped apart by the media, because it was put up as this big Boots Riley like tears
called
down.
It, called it an attack.
And it wasn't. You kind of, at the very start, you acknowledged that he's a huge influence.
Yeah,
he's a
master filmmaker, a huge influence on me. Like I said, why I went to film school in the first place. Black Klansman was masterfully acted, shot. Matter of fact, Chase Irvin, who shot that, was somebody who I had been talking to about shooting Sorry to Bother You. Right, you know, like, there's you know, Jordan's one of the producers, a friend of mine. Jordan was actually the first Cassius, you know?
Oh,
like,
really?
Yeah, yeah. And,
oh, wow.
And he directed Get Out. Then he said, I don't want to act anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, there's none of that. But I believe that people should talk about the ideas that are put out there. I believe every movie is political. I don't care if it's a comedy about farting. You know, it's, you know, everything has an idea.
Yeah,
that's because we all have ideas and we can't get away from it. But my point about Black Klansman was just that, and the time when I wrote that, I wish I hadn't only read half of the memoir, because once I read more of it, I was a little more mad. But but the point is that and Spike, you know, didn't really have to do with the making of the screenplay.
Yeah.
Someone else wrote it. But the original dude's memoir, he infiltrated not only the Klan, but radical organizations.
Yeah.
Black organizations. He actually infiltrated the organization my parents were in.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was called Progressive Labor Party, which was an organization I later joined. Reason for that was that they had a slogan that said "Smash the Klan."
Yeah,
and they would go stop Klan rallies.
Yeah.
And so the actual dude went to those meetings, found out how they were going to try to stop the Klan rallies, was telling his people, who then was working with the Klan around planning those rallies.
So
tell me what that is, you know.
Yeah.
But the point is this, is that, you know, let's look at what these things are doing, and making movies where cops are the heroes is nothing new.
Yeah.
There's probably 1,000 of them this year.
Yeah, of course.
And so it's not just with that movie. However, in order to make something where the police are the heroes against racism, the only way you're going to do that is by adding none of the heroic stuff actually happened.
Yeah.
Whatever. And that particular cop happened to do some really dirty stuff and was not actually working against the Klan. Matter of fact, he was part of helping convince the dude that was leading the Klan to not move.
Right.
To keep the Klan going.
Yeah.
And which they could have just done that. Anyway, that was my whole point. And here's the reason. One of the reasons I felt comfortable saying it is that Spike Lee is a cultural critic.
Yeah.
You know, he has talked major shit about all other kinds of filmmakers, black and white. You know, he's calling Tyler Perry a coon and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not saying he's wrong for the things that he was saying. Most of the things I can remember him saying, I agree with.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But the point is that many people in the media tried to take it as some big, you know, beef or whatever. I think that there was some idea that, you know, black filmmakers shouldn't be saying things about each other. But I think that we should be talking about the, you know, the ideas behind what we do.
Completely. I couldn't agree more. And we have to wrap things up now, but thank you very much for your time, man. It's been, I'm glad we got to do this.
All right, cool.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Boots Riley. That was a joy. I wish we'd had twice as long. It felt like we could have talked for hours. I hope our paths cross again soon. And I look forward to all that is ahead. I'd love to work with Boots down the line. I think I made that clear in the episode and outside of the episode. So, great dude. I really enjoyed that. As said, if that bit right at the end there about Spike Lee intrigues you, go and have a listen to the episode with Spike Lee. He also did an excellent episode with Blind Boy from the Rubber Bandits on the Blind Boy podcast. So check that out. What else do I need to tell you about? Next week, I've got Russell Kane. It's a fantastic one. And then we'll be going into Drunk Cast territory and Films of the Year territory. I might be doing a secret special bonus podcast in the middle somewhere, but I'm not going to announce it or tell you too much about it. I'm just going to sneak it out. So like and subscribe and you'll be the first to get that. I'm recording next week or this week as you listen to this. I'm recording three new guests and the Drunk Cast, and with all of them I'll be posting kind of exclusive behind the scenes stuff and revealing who the guests are over at patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. But while I've got you, I normally have the club night to plug and all that. The club night's back at the end of January. I've got Gemma Kearney, but it's nice to have a bit of a break from having to plug live things and all these other things. But what I do want to do is update you on some of the other podcasts on the network, because Films to Be Buried with Brett Goldstein has been amazing lately. His last two guests have been Will Poulter, who was a great Distraction Pieces guest earlier in the year. End of last year, was it? End of last year. No, early, at some point. End of last year, yeah. And Ricky Gervais, who I've been trying to get on for bloody ages. So that's a huge one. I also really enjoyed his Ashlyn B one a little while back. I'm just scrolling through. His Jade Adam ones and Jack Whitehall ones were both amazing. I'm scrolling through and I stopped the Nick Helm one halfway through and I was really enjoying that. So I need to go back and finish that off. That's kind of irrelevant news. Hardcore Listing, of course, always absolute gold. They had an episode recently I can't recommend highly enough. It was a few weeks back. It was episode 90 with Gary Hayes, and it's about PTSD of the emergency services, essentially. It's a great one. They also had the B Ducks episode with top five Robin Williams films, and or last week's Josh Ashtrop one with top five podcasts. How much more relevant to you could that be? As you are all podcast listeners. So that's been great. Also wanted to mention Off the Beaten Track has been amazing recently. Honestly, last month's run of guests was ridiculous. I mean, right, here's November. Have this. On Stuart Whiffin's Off the Beaten Track podcast, Alan McGee of Creation Records, absolute legend, obviously, Rowena Alice, also a legend, one of my previous favourite Hardcore Listening episodes. But then look at this run of three. Gail Porter, Ian Lee and Dom Jolly, all talking about their favourite songs and the stories, or not even their favourite songs, the songs that soundtrack their upbringing and their lives and their experience, how they got into them. So yeah, he's just been on fire of late on that one, so I recommend that. Say Why to Drugs is of course still out there for reference. If you don't know about Say Why to Drugs, myself and Dr. Susie Gage sit down and discuss. We pick a drug each week and she brings in the facts and the stats and a breakdown of the honest realities about each drug. I bring a bit of my own experiences of some of the drugs, because although I don't do any drugs now, I've played with a few in the past. They're great episodes, and she's been doing some live ones of late, so I don't know if they're going to be released. I think they are, so that's exciting. But also the Stop and Search podcast is kind of the unsung hero of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This year they've done... So basically the Stop and Search podcast is about the legal system and essentially drug law in the UK and the world. It's by Jason Reed of Leap UK, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And man, they've done, earlier this year, that they did a podcast in Parliament with MPs discussing drug law and policy, which is amazing. Like, it's groundbreaking. It's never happened before. And then only a few weeks back, they did a podcast inside a cannabis social club in London. So a secret... a members cannabis club in London with, you know, police crime and crime commissioner, a doctor and lecturer, and the chair of the UK cannabis social club movement. So these are genuinely groundbreaking podcasts that are kind of in the charity sector or in the activism sector. And yeah, it's kind of a bit of an unsung hero of the Distraction Pieces Network. So I wanted to give that a plug. And Tuesday Night Jaw, it's starting to make its return. Jim did four in October, and I believe he's got... He didn't get a chance to do any in November, but I believe he's got big plans for December and going forward. So check them out. Yeah, the network is firing on all cylinders, and I wanted to kind of tell you about that and get you up to date. Another thing I wanted to plug was last week's guest, David Lowry. We talked in there on that episode about his amazing film. I've got up and started to stroll around my landing. I wanted to plug his new film, The Old Man and the Gun, because it's really good. And as said in the podcast, I gave it the best kind of byline. Oh, I'm a bit hiccupy and burpy, sorry. The best byline or hype you could possibly do, or all you need to know about it, is it's a heist movie, and the gang is Robert Redford in his last ever role, and I would say arguably his greatest. He saved the best till last. Yeah, so the gang is Robert Redford, Danny Glover, and Tom Waits. As if you don't want to see that movie, I recommend you getting into the cinema. Blag a day off work. Just don't. Just winter. There's train troubles, all sorts of stuff. You'll be able to get away with it. Colds, flus, and spend the day in the cinema catching. Sorry to bother you, an old man with a gun. They couldn't be more different. But they're both charming and unique and wonderful. So yeah, I wanted to plug them things. Also, big plug and shout out to Buddy Peace, who produces the podcast. If you are a podcaster, then give Buddy Peace a shout. If you need a producer or someone to put things together, run that ship, mastering, editing, tweaking. He's the best. So, yeah, I recommend any podcasters listening, jumping on that. Also, I'll mention, as we're at the end, I'm excited that in the new year, I'm going to be working with Stuart Whiffin, Adam Richardson, and a few other people on a thing called Pod Bible. You might have seen Stu talking about it online. It's his kind of creation, along with Adam and a few others. And it's going to be a free podcast magazine that's a digital version and a physical version, starting off in London. It will be handed out at train stations and stuff like that. And yeah, it's kind of awesome. I'm excited to be involved because Acast are involved. It looks like Spotify are going to be involved. And yeah, it's really exciting to realise that no one's been doing this before and no one's done this. So yeah, keep an eye. I'm not going to say too much more. There's some big plans ahead, some huge guests involved and wonderful stuff because we all love listening to podcasts and we all need new recommendations and finding new stuff. And at this point, you generally hear about new podcasts through friends' recommendations or other podcasters talking about good podcasts or everyone guesting on their own on each other's podcasts in the big podcast circle jerk. Shout out to my homies, Richard Herring and Adam Buxton. We are the trifecta. We do all appear on each other's podcasts. And the fact is, I'm a fan of theirs. I listen to them constantly. I've been having a good binge on Richard Herring's podcast recently. And I recommend you buy his emergency questions book to make sure he beats the toilet book thing he keeps going on about in the charts. And also Alex Horn's Taskmaster book, another one. I enjoyed Alex on Richard Herring recently. It was great. I think Alex Horn is the most underrated podcast guest. I've been thinking about it a lot recently. Every time he's on anything, he's brilliant. He's consistently brilliant as a guest. I've not caught his own podcast yet, Alex Horn in the Horn Section. But yeah, he's a consistently great guest. So yeah, anyway, I'm rambling on. I'm recommending loads of stuff. Christmas is coming. Head over to patreon.com/scroobiouspip. This week's a good week to join up. As I said, it's a quid, and you'll get to find out who these guests are. I'm recording to go out next year, so you'll get that excitement. And they're good ones, I tell you. And yeah, speechdevelopmentrecords.com is where you can buy stuff. Christmas gifts, I've got a signed section. So you can buy a signed Distraction Pieces podcast book, poetry and emotion book, Live at the Edinburgh Fringe DVD, CDs, vinyl, all sorts of good stuff. So head over there for all of that. And I will see you next week with Russell Kane, who's actually, let's mention his podcast, Evil Genius, is fantastic. The reason he's on is to talk about that. We hardly talk about it at all because we grew up in similar areas and go off on these crazy tangents. But yeah, check Evil Genius out. It's cracking. Yeah, I'll see you next week. I told you it was going to be a long outro. Bye.
Hold up. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.